You filed a flight plan to Mountain Rescue. If we don't report in, they'll come looking for us.
Now, that's how it's supposed to work, except I put in a flight plan for Borum Caverns, and this isn't Borum Caverns, is it, Juno?
We're in the wrong cave.
Where are we?
It hasn't got a name. It's a new system. No one's ever been down here before.
Let me ask you a question. Would you prefer to stay alive without your mommy and daddy, or die with them? That's a tough question, huh?
It was moving, it was alive, it knows we're here, we just have to go,
we can't do that.
You didn't see it. I'm not staying here.
If we try to leave, they'd kill us.
We're being quarantined here! We are being kept here to die!
While you were looking for me, I was looking for you. Well, got you now.
Was that him in the car?
Yeah, sure it was. Didn't walk very far.
Why is that?
Because I cut off his legs.
And I'm gonna do the same to you.
Hello, welcome to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, sir, how are you?
I am well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. And in the, well, actually, a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
I am fine, thank you.
Excellent. And Eric, what is Dark Discussions? And where can people find us? And what can they find on the website?
Well, the website is darkdiscussions.com. And they can find a whole bunch of stuff on the website. On the right-hand side of the page, we have links to a bunch of associated podcasts and projects and blogs, including my own and Mike's blog. We have a link to a section with articles that have been written by myself as well as others. We have a link to all of the past episodes of the podcast, not only Dark Discussions, but all of the spinoff shows as well, including You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, American Gods, and Bullets, Brothels, and Bots. And front and center, we have a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that allows you to support your online artists, like podcasters, if you'd like to help us offset the cost of producing this show. There are costs involved, trust me, server fees and equipment and so on and so forth. You can go follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. We take all entries and draw them on a quarterly basis. For more details, you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions.
That's right. And we already pulled one few weeks ago, The Devil's Advocate, which was picked by Holly Masiak. That will be recorded soon enough. And congratulations to her. And thank you to her and all our other Patreon supporters. We here at Dark Discussions for New Listeners basically talk about a genre film weekly, a critique and review, such as horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, cult films, art house, and midnight movies. We also have an email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, where you can give us your opinions and also suggestions, and we will read those emails on the podcast. And on Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group is a lot of conversation about things such as horror films, Game of Thrones, American Gods, and various other topics. Big one right now is the Chucky remake, I guess. And so a lot of discussion going on there. So join us at Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. All right. I think that's pretty much it. We'll get into some house cleaning and news and things of that nature at the end of the episode. But I think it's time to probably get into our topic tonight. And Eric, what is that topic?
Tonight, we're going to be talking about the 2007 film by the Coen brothers, No Country for Old Men.
Let me ask you something. What's the most you ever lost in a coin toss?
Look, I need to know what I stand to win.
Everything. Just call it Friendo.
Willen, what's in the satchel?
A full of money.
He's just a guy who happened to find that money.
I got a bad feeling, Llewellyn.
It's a mess, ain't it, Sheriff?
If it ain't, it'll do till the mess gets here.
I'm looking for Llewellyn Moss.
You go up to his trailer?
Yes.
Do you want to leave a message?
Yes.
I don't come back and tell Mother I love her.
Your mother's dead.
Well, then I'll tell her myself.
Got a loose skin in here.
You think this boy Moss has got any notion of the sorts that are hunting him?
I don't know. He ought to. He's seen the same things I've seen, and it certainly made an impression on me.
Just how dangerous is he?
Compared to what? The bubonic plague?
The crime you see now, it's hard to even take its measure. It's just all out war.
You can't stop what's coming.
What's this guy supposed to be, the ultimate badass?
You don't understand.
That's right. No Country for Old Men is a 2007 film, as Eric said. It is a crime thriller. They also call it neo-western, some people say. Joel and Ethan Coen directed it, which are probably best known for, well, they're known for many things. But my
Fargo and Big Lebowski would probably be the two best known, would be my guess.
What about, didn't they do that Velvet? The Blue Velvet too, or something like that? Or was that
no,
that wasn't them.
No, that wasn't them. Okay, but
that was David Lynch.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. Fargo is probably their big one. Most people consider that a masterpiece, and oddly, most people consider this movie tonight, No Country for Old Men, a masterpiece as well. This is from Cormac McCarthy's 2005 novel of the same name. Cormac McCarthy is one of the America's greatest authors in the last, I don't know, 50 years. A lot of folks would concur. He's written many books. A number of them have become movies, such as this one and The Road.
One that has not, my co-host Dan on the Askansi podcast has been obsessed with the book for some time, is Blood Meridian.
Apparently, that's an awesome one.
There's some dude in that book that walks around chopping off people's ears and making a necklace out of them. So I haven't checked it out, but I intend to someday.
I heard that at one point that film, I mean, that was supposed to be a film by Ridley Scott, and it never was made.
Oh, that's a bummer.
Yeah. But I heard that is an awesome book as well. I actually read No Country for Old Men, the book, a couple of months after I had seen the movie. I saw the movie at the theaters. We'll discuss how we heard about the film and what we thought about it in a moment. And the screenplay was written by Joel Coen and Ethan Coen as well. Won 4 Academy Awards, 8 nominations. The awards it won was Best Picture, Best Directors, for a second time ever. Co-directors won the Academy Award. Best Adapted Screenplay and Best Supporting Actor, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And whatnot. The cast includes Tommy Lee Jones, Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, Woody Harrelson, Kelly MacDonald, Garrett Dillahunt, just to name the main characters in the movie, or I should say the main actors in the movie. what I was going to say. This was the film that brought Javier Bardem to American audiences, pretty much, though I had already seen him multiple times from a number of Spanish films or Spain films that I had watched prior. So when he was cast, it was a pretty interesting move, though it was originally offered to Heath Ledger, who turned it down due to conflicts. So let's go around and say how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. So let's start with you first, Mike.
How did I first hear about it? The movie came out in 2007. I don't know. It was 2007. It was a movie. We went to see it in the movie theater. You know, that's what we did back in 2007. So I don't know. I'm sure there was an ad campaign. It's the Coen brothers. I'm sure I read about it someplace. But yeah, I remember seeing it. I remember liking it, being a little bit perplexed by the ending on the first viewing. I still think the ending is, you know, kind of anticlimactic, and it doesn't pay off in a way traditional cinematic film will. But I still think it's a really, really solid film. It has some interesting ideas and interesting themes in it. Some fantastic performances and just great direction and cinematography. You know, if people haven't seen this film yet, I don't understand why.
All right, very good. For me, I remember it clearly how I heard about this film. Basically, I had seen Fargo, and I loved that film. So the Coen brothers were always someone that after that point of interest to me. And then when No Country for Old Men came out, I heard it was by the Coen brothers. Roger Ebert reviewed it, gave it really good reviews, and I saw that it was like getting like rave reviews everywhere. This was actually my first experience with Cormac McCarthy's as well. Me and my girlfriend at the time, which is my wife now, went to see it when we were visiting my parents down on Cape Cod. We went out one night to go see the film, basically, and I was blown away. This film is one of the best films I've ever seen, and that is not hyperbole. It is a phenomenal story, phenomenal thriller, phenomenal acting, phenomenal sound and ambience, cinematography. You name it, it has it. Total masterpiece. And Roger Ebert summed it up perfectly, which was that most people would pray for a film by Fargo, and then they did it again with No Country for Old Men. I love this film. It's an amazing classic, and everybody should see it. And if they haven't, as Mike said, I would be surprised. So I highest recommend. This may be one of the top three or four best films that we'll ever do review on the podcast, along with films like Psycho and Taxi Driver and whatnot. So, yeah, awesome film. Let's go with Eric.
Oh, you threw me a curve there. I thought you were going to Christian desk. Yeah, okay, sorry. I thought I was muted for a second. so this, yeah, I can't really add much to what everybody else has said about this. I saw it because the Coen brothers were involved. Everything everybody else has said about this movie is true. I watched it actually two times in the last week prepping for this episode. And on my last watch, I was paying more attention to the look of the film than the actual plot of the film. And the cinematography of this movie is just amazing because a lot of it is shot at night. And they managed to have it be very dark. So, you know, you're not watching any day for night or anything like that. And it's very dark, and still you can see everything that you need to be able to see. And I imagine that's very difficult to do. So it's amazing. It's a great movie. And yeah, everybody should check it out.
All right. Chrissy.
I really enjoyed this movie. However, I had heard of this movie, but had never seen it. And once I saw it, I kind of understood why I never saw it. I don't really gravitate toward movies like this. As you said, it's a neo-Western. I think my husband kind of put it best when he said it's like a mix of Quentin Tarantino and John Wayne. And I went, yeah, that's kind of why I didn't really care for this film. I mean, it's not, I recognize that it's an awesome film. It's extremely tight. The cinematography is gorgeous. The script is amazing. The performances are wonderful. The violence is understated and only when necessary. This is certainly a classic film that everyone should see. However, I do think it really is kind of what I like to call a dick pic. It's kind of more geared toward men. And it just kind of has things in it that I was kind of like, yeah, I'm not really interested in this. It was sort of, like I said, not that it wasn't good. It just really didn't hold my interest. There were certain times when I was really into it. And then other times where I was like, oh, okay, we're going to go see some bloody things now. Okay. I'm going to do some stuff on my computer and then I'll come back. So I really think it has a target audience. And I probably am not that target audience, but I'm not going to say that it's not an awesome film. And the fact that it actually won, I believe it won Best Picture, didn't it?
Yes,
in the Oscars?
Did.
It won Best Picture and it won several awards. And I remember saying to Charles last night, I said to him, oh my God, you mean a film won the Oscars that actually freaking deserves to win the Oscars, because this movie totally deserves it. But as far as hearing about it, I've never seen it before, and I probably never would have seen it had it not been for you guys recommending it. So anyway, that's my thoughts.
All right, very good. That's No Country for Old Men. Our opinions are as they are. I don't want to say. I think me and Eric probably love the film the most, again, it's probably hit our target. We're part of the direct target audience for this film. I did too, Eric. I watched the film twice in the last week as well. All right, so Eric, do we have a wiki?
Wiki. All right. Violence and mayhem ensue after a hunter stumbles upon a drug dealer gone wrong and more than $2 million in cash near the Rio Grande.
That's it. Yeah, that's a good one. It doesn't tell you much, which is good. Yeah, because it's the film is definitely more about something other than the money and the thriller aspect. I mean, it's about human nature and I guess how the world has some issues, and it's specifically related to people, not to anything else.
Well, structurally, it's weird because it's basically not about the main characters in the film.
Right.
It's much more about Tommy Lee Jones, who gets top billing, but of the nominal leads in the film, he actually has the least amount of screen time.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more about him and, you know, people in their place in the world. And yet, you know, that's not the plot of the film. Mm-hmm. It's a weird thing. And I think I understand why some people were, you know, a little thrown by that when it first came out. And especially, you know, they throw, which I'm sure we'll talk about, they throw a curve at you at the end of the film or near the end of the film that everyone, I think, who goes in, who's used to seeing films play out a certain way, we're waiting for. And they never got to see it.
Right. Well, Mike, it's interesting that you said that about the Tommy Lee Jones character who plays basically the sheriff. And not to do the in the book, Eric, I just have to bring it up here, is that similar to American Gods, me and Mike do a Searching for American Gods podcast about the American Gods TV show on Stars. And our concern in that show is the lead character, Shadow Moon, seems to not really be the lead character, even though in the book he was supposed to be the lead character. And me and Mike never read the book. And so I always bring up in our podcast that maybe Shadow Moon was really like a narrative character in the book. And so when it was brought to screen, he falls back because, again, you don't have much narration. And oddly, this book here is exactly that. The Tommy Lee Jones character, or the sheriff, every chapter in the book begins with him narrating kind of a story. And then once he's done doing that, it goes into the main plot, which are Anton Chigurh and Llewellyn Moss and so forth. So it is interesting that you noted that, Mike, because that's exactly the case. In the book, he is the main character, and he's on the page the most because he's narrating the beginning of each chapter. But when it goes to film, his character becomes oddly more secondary character, even if the role is, quote-unquote, the lead. Anyway, so that was interesting that you noted that, Mike.
But when he is on screen, you know, it's a good character. It's a great performance by Tommy Lee Jones. His purpose is for being there is, well, it seems to be obvious at the time in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But it's not really until you get to the end of the story that it's sort of revealed that, and when you think about it, that's really his tale, because he's the only one, again, if you look at the idea that the character in a story has to change, he's the only character, or at least the only character that doesn't die, who is changed by the proceedings in the film.
So that was a good note, and I'm glad you brought that up, Mike. Let's see, any other items of note that people wanted to bring up? Because eventually we're going to get into the spoiler-fied territory, and we'll talk about anything and everything.
Well, I mean, I love the Coen brothers, which is easily one of their best films. I like even most of their lesser films. But this was a film, every now and then there are films that just the way it's set up just drags you in right from the beginning. You know, and it just, there's a feeling about it, either about the way it's shot or edited or paced, something that just, again, to me, speaks straight to me. And this is one of those films that did that, like had me gripped from the first frame. But also, you know, one of the hallmarks of almost any modern Coen Brothers film is that they always have a fantastic cast. And there's a lot of actors who will, you know, give their left arm in order to be in one of their films. You know, and so this is another one that's got, you know, somebody like Woody Harrelson in a very small role in the movie, or Stephen Root in a very small role in the film. But they don't just stunt cast, because Javier Bardem, you know, was more or less a nobody at the time that they cast him.
At least in the States.
In the States.
Yeah, because he was a leading man in Spain.
Yeah, but you know that there was no studio exec who was going, thank God we got Javier Bardem as the villain in this movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. No, I would agree with that, Mike. I mean, I like I said, I had already seen him in a number of films from Spain. And so I knew who he was, and I always thought he was a good actor. And again, his performances were all in Spanish. So obviously the translation of acting in a foreign language to my first language of English, I can't judge it 100% if he was a good actor, but I could definitely tell that it seemed that way, even though he was speaking a different language. So when he got cast here and everybody was raving about his performance before I had even seen the film, I was very excited, because I had always felt that he was solid in all his roles. And in Spain, he plays not just heavies, but I knew here that he was going to be playing a heavy, and he has that you know, he's the man's man. So it made sense that they would put him in a role like this. And so when I saw him and saw his performance, I was completely amazed and knew.
It's a hell of a performance.
Yeah.
And one of the most interesting things to me about it is that, and I don't know how much of this was him acting or written into the character by the book or the script, but the fact that he was, first of all, just so off, just so strange, gives him a really weird air about him to begin with. And then also the fact that he's this basically unstoppable murdering machine. But he never seems to act with any sense of urgency. He's just doing his thing. Do 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 dead. It just made it even more creepy to me than somebody who'd be like running at full tilt or yelling at people while he's doing all this. So it's a hell of a performance, and I really appreciate it.
And I think people like at characters that are good at their jobs, you know, even if they're a terrible job. And I was watching, it was like, he's reminding me of another character. I was having a hard time placing it. And near the end of the film, I went, oh, he reminded me a lot of Mike Ehrmantraut from Breaking Bad.
Oh, yeah, you know, okay.
And that he's the consummate professional, goes about his job. He's now Mike has a different personality, but in terms of, you know, he finds like common everyday objects to sort of do the task, right? You know, like he uses his coins for whatever he wants to use his coins for. He finds very simple ways, but it's also very thorough, you know? So like, I love the scene, and this goes to the character. Obviously every character is not just about the acting, but also the writing, where he's going to break into Llewellyn's hotel room. So he rents another hotel room so he can go in and see the layout of the room and walk through the room and see where is it that he's, you know, that where are the danger points? Where could Llewellyn be hiding when he busts into the room? You know, and they never tell you that's what he's doing. You kind of have to piece that together, you know, but I think that's just a, you know, a great little bit that they do with him. And I also love that, well, his voice almost never changes throughout the film. He always delivers things. Like I say, he doesn't have a sense of urgency. You can also, though, tell there are times in the movie where he's getting really frustrated with the person he's talking with.
In the gas station.
Like in the gas station. Where he says,
or the woman at the mobile home park.
Right. Pick heads or tails. Heads or tails. You know, he doesn't scream at them. He doesn't speed up his pacing. It's all in the face. It's all in his expression and his delivery. You know, but if you were just playing the audio of it, you wouldn't necessarily pick that up.
Well, and that's some good points that both you and Eric bring up, Mike. In the book, he is off a little bit, and the words or sentences that he speaks in the movie are directly pulled from the book. So when you get to do that, obviously you can get a different, you can have performance to emphasize certain words and whatnot, and then the haircut and the way he moves and speaks were intentional to emphasize that he's a little off, because obviously, unlike the written word, you can't really describe it. It has to be all visual. So he didn't have this haircut in the book, for example, but by having him have a Beatles haircut in 1980, which is when this movie's supposed to take place, it makes him a little odd in the first place. And then, like Mikey, how you said, he speaks slowly and calmly. And yet when he does get upset, he you can tell without him really going bonkers. And that's all because of the visual and audio that you don't get in the book. And so they have to do little things in the movie to, I guess, make up for what they would lose from the written page. And Bardem literally hits it out of the ballpark.
Right. It's also obvious the character, again, never stated, but the character is obviously suffering from some form of OCD.
That's fair.
That's a good one. I didn't even thought of that, Mike. You're probably right.
Well, because, you know, like the thing with the coin.
Yeah.
He doesn't say, oh, well, fuck it, I'll shoot you anyway. He needs them to choose. You know, he's frustrated because they're not picking. He needs them to pick. You know, what he does at the end of the movie by visiting the wife, he didn't have to do that, except he had to do that. Nobody would know. Nobody would care. No one knows what he said to Llewellyn. No one knew any of that. You know, it's a matter of, well, he said this. It's a matter of principle for him. He had to do that.
Right.
Well, and also, too, I mean, it's kind of interesting that you bring this up, because I did notice that. I have a friend who has a form of OCD, and he has this compulsion to finish stuff. And that's kind of what I felt like when I was watching this character visit the wife. I was like, oh, he has to completely finish the job, or he needs to feel like he has completely finished what he set out to do. And so, because he's not going to kill the wife or whatever, he needs to go and put the finishing thing on it and say, okay, well, I at least need to go explain to her that I'm not going to finish this. Do you know what I mean? So that was kind of what I got out of it, which, you're right, is directly tied to OCD.
Well, Carson Wells,
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Carson Wells summed it up perfectly when he spoke to Stephen Root's character, where he goes, the man has principles, and he basically, it's warped, basically, but he follows a certain type, certain set of rules and principles, whether it's OCD or not. Mm-hmm. It's something that he does because he thinks it's right. So even though Llewellyn is already out of the picture, technically Mike's right. He doesn't have to continue to go to the wife, even though he had already told Llewellyn that he was going to go after the wife. But he does it anyway because it's part of his rules and principles. And I never really thought of that as OCD. I always felt, when I've watched this film a number of times since 2007, of him just having his psychopathic principles and he's going to follow them all the way. But you're right. Even a psychopath could break rules and principles
we all have things that we're obsessive, that we have some OCD about. We all have things that we have to have done a certain way, right? Everyone has that to some degree. It's a matter of just how much does it impact your life and how extensive.
Hello, welcome
is it
to Dark Discussion Show.
Exactly, right? So it's not that unusual. And yeah, and we can then dress them up as, you know, as principles. But like, if you put Carson Wells, if you put Carson Wells in Anton Chigurh's role, right, and you put him through the same exact steps and have him going through the same, he would have had no trouble walking away and leaving the wife be.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because what was the point? He doesn't need to do it.
Right.
So it's not just a matter of a professional. It's the fact that he's compelled to follow that professional code.
That's curious that you said that. Because, go on.
Do we have a spoiler flag up at this point?
No, we don't, but we can if you want to.
I think we probably should.
Okay, sounds good. So if people don't want this movie spoiled, they should go and watch the film now and come back to listen. But if you've already seen the film or you don't really care to have it spoiled, you can continue listening now. So go ahead, Eric.
No, I was just going to say that, damn it, I can't remember what I was going to say now. I just didn't want to spoil anything accidentally.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. So we're in spoiler territory now. So if you come up with any other ideas that you wanted to bring up, Eric, well, this is the time to do it. But what I was going to say was, Carson Wells is a guy that wants to get the job done. And once the job's done, he moves on. While Anton Chigurh, his job is everything that he promises he has to continue doing. So, yeah, I guess it is an OCD. I still am amazed to think that, but it never occurred to me until now that was an OCD, because you're right. If you did replace Chigurh with Wells, Wells would have got the money and actually brought him in, not killed Moss, Llewellyn Moss, and then probably would have just got his payday and be done with it. So, yeah, that is an interesting thing. So, yeah. All right. All right. So where do we want to go from here? Since now we can talk about anything and everything.
I have a couple of plot questions for you guys. Okay. There are a couple of things in this movie upon watching it twice in a week that kind of popped out at me like, what? And here's the first one. And actually, this is the main one I need help understanding. Which is that when Llewellyn goes to the hotel with the money, right? And he rents the one room and he takes the bag of money and he stuffs it in the air vent. And then he goes and he rents another room and gets the room on the other side from it. And then goes to a sporting goods store and gets a tent with a bunch of tent poles. And then comes back and uses it to retrieve the bag of money through the air duct from the other room. Is it just me, or is that an awful lot of foresight? Because here are several things I don't understand about this situation. A, the first thing I don't understand is if the bad guys, for lack of a better term, the people who were after him to get their money back, if they found him and find out that he's staying in the one room, how do they not also find out at the same time that he has the other one?
Well, I'll tell you how it happened, Eric. Basically, what happens is that he's already paranoid that people are out to get him because he has the money.
Well, and he's right.
He is right. So when he has the cab driver driving back to his motel, he sees something suspicious. We're not sure what it is that he sees suspicious, but he basically panics a little bit. He says, all right, keep on driving. Don't stop. And the driver says, well, I should just let you off here. I don't want to get involved. And he goes, here's $100. Take me to another hotel. You know. And so what happens is when he comes back, he gets to the other room.
Is like that the order that, in which that happened?
Yes. And okay. He gets
to the other room. Because I thought he took the cab after he'd done the whole deal with the money bag.
No.
Oh, okay. All right.
And so what happens is the reason these folks can find him isn't by his name, because only Chigurh has his name, because he got the license and all that. Mm-hmm. But the Mexicans and the other bounty hunters, like Carson Wells, they don't have his name. But the Mexicans have, and Carson Wells, I believe, as well, have the transmitters, too.
Right. But he didn't know that.
He didn't.
No. Yeah, he didn't figure out the transmitter till the second hotel.
But that's not the point. That Eric asked, how did they find him? And I said, it's because the Mexicans also had the transmitter, too. They didn't
That wasn't my question.
What was your
question? My question was, how did Llewellyn know that he would need that other room
to escape? Well, he knew that. He knew something was wrong, as I mentioned. So he assumed they either knew his name or knew something about it. And so he wasn't going to go back.
But we don't know what he knew they knew.
I think, if I remember correctly, and it's hard because I don't know what room it is. But
138 and 38.
But, okay. What I'm saying is, like, when he was driving by, I couldn't read the room numbers.
138.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't read the room numbers, so I don't know for sure that what room I was seeing on the screen.
Well, that's
but they should. I know the number I'm saying, but I don't know what rooms they were that they were seeing on the screen. All right. So when the car's driving by, he knows they're going to be looking for him, whether they know it's him or not. You know, it's why they left the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because I noticed it was because that he cuts the curtain cord. Right. And then he pulls the curtain shut, which he has to do by hand because the curtain cords are cut. I think as he drives by the hotel room, he sees the curtains are open.
Nice catch, Mike.
And that could easily just have been a maid coming in, although he could have put the do not disturb sign on there. But if he put the do not disturb sign on there and the curtains are open, then it wasn't the maid. But even if he didn't, it could have been the maid. He's just, part of the problem is he's being paranoid.
Right.
For a reason, but he is being paranoid. And you can go through everything he does in the film, and he's just screaming out, you know, conspicuous behavior, you know, that here is a person people are going to
hitchhiking with a bag of money.
Hitchhiking with a bag of money, paying everything in $100 bills in 1980, you know, which would still be unusual in 2018. But the film is set in 1980, so a $100 bill was even more money then, let alone to be paying for shoes, socks, hotel rooms, you know, with $100 bills, and mostly crisp, clean $100 bills or blood-soaked $100 bills. You know, these are all things that are going to stand out as his behavior being a bit odd.
Okay. You know? I just couldn't put two to two together how he figured out he needed the other room. I was like, that's some awfully strong intuition.
He knew one thing, which is he wasn't going back to the room that he originally rented, which is 138, because he at least thought, whether it was true or not, which we know it was true, he found out that somebody knew he was in that room. And as Mike said, they obviously were based off of the curtains. So since he already had the money bag in the air duct, which leads to all, you know, air ducts that go across the whole building. He wanted the room directly behind it because that's the one that he could just pull it straight back to where he.
No, is. That I get. I was just wondering how he knew he needed it.
He also might not have known. He might have just been
lucky.
And again, his paranoia. Right. So I'm just rewatching it now. So yeah, he definitely pulls the curtains closed all the way.
That's all right. We don't need to watch the movie on the podcast.
No, that's all
right. Right, right.
Well, and, I mean,
so I think after he figured out he wasn't going to be able to go back to that room, he said, "Okay, I have to do something and get the money. I'll get it through the air ducts from the room literally behind it."
Well, no, but I can't admit. Okay, here's the other thing: is that I can't imagine he put that bag that far back in the air duct without having formed the plan to get it from the other side.
Well, either way, he did push it. What he did was he pushed it way back. And he put it into off to the left of the air duct because, you know, the central air duct.
Right.
And he did that intentionally. So if someone looked in, they wouldn't see it. The only way they would see it is if they unscrewed the whole air duct.
Okay.
And,
all right.
And yeah, so.
But he also had it tied to the curtain rod. The curtain cord.
Yes.
Because his plan was to.
Okay. His original plan was to pull it back out into the first room.
Yes. Right.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I got it. Thank you. Yeah.
Right, and then that's the reason why he had to get the poles, because now he had to reach further because he was going from another room.
Right, right.
Now, Chris, are you going to say something?
I was just going to say that I kind of understood Eric's question, because when I was watching that sequence, I was very confused about why would you shove that in the central duct, but you also didn't know at the time that the other room wasn't rented. So how did he know that he could rent the other room? I mean, to
he
me, did, that
he
whole...
Well, he didn't, I guess.
Yeah.
See, that's why he went to that woman and he asked, I want another room. And then
show
he started...
Show me a map. Yeah.
Show me a map. And he says, I want room 38. And she goes, why do you want room 38? I can give you the room right next to it, which is like 137. And he goes, no, I want room 38. And then she says, but that has double beds, meaning, you know, you're all alone. So it was just lucky. He was just lucky that... The room was empty.
Well, this is also a callback to him saying when he booked the room and she asked, you know, what option do you want? He said,
because
well,
I'm
by
just
myself.
One person, it doesn't matter.
Right. So yep. That was a callback to that. And yeah, I just rewatched it. As they drive by, he sees the curtain is open.
Oh, so the curtain's open and that's what tips him off.
Right.
Gotcha. Okay, cool.
Which I want to point out, if it was Anton Chigurh, that curtain would not be open.
True.
That's true.
Although what I really sort of enjoy also about this movie kind of was that Nathan has seen this movie many times and so has Charles. And in fact, it was a real treat for me because Charles has the Blu-ray.
Mm-hmm.
And this was one comment that I wanted to mention, because I started watching the movie on Netflix. And the cinematography in this movie is beautiful. I did want to say this earlier, but we kind of jumped in. But also the landscapes are gorgeous. But one of the
God,
things,
Christy,
there
is one shot in particular. It's when after he discovers the money initially, when he's going back to his truck, and there's that wide shot of him approaching this truck with a storm in the background.
Oh God, it's phenomenal.
That
was
one
of
the most
gorgeous
shots I've ever
seen. Shots.
Yeah. Speaking of shots was when he's about to shoot the antelope and the cloud in the sky makes a shadow over the flat desert landscape. And I thought that was awesome too.
But what was interesting was I watched the first 15 minutes on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to stop because I was doing something. And so I said, okay, you know what? I'm just going to start this movie over tomorrow because I'm too busy right now. And I mentioned to Charles, and Charles goes, oh, well, the hell with that. We're not watching this on Netflix. I got the deluxe Blu-ray of this because I love this movie. Let's put it in. Oh my God.
It looks so good, doesn't it?
The difference was mind blowing. I was like, this.
And that's why
is
I have 300
gorgeous
movies on disc. Yes.
On the Blu-ray. But my point in mentioning this is you really, because of the way the landscape is almost a character in this film, and it's very important to the theme, one of the themes anyway, especially the shadows. You know, the shadows in those opening shots are so dark. And it really, along with Tommy Lee Jones's overlaying speech, sets us up for the idea that everyone has something dark in them. And, you know, the speech kind of reflects that, too, you know, where he talks about the guy who killed the girl and he said he'd do it again to anyone and that he was going to hell and he'd be there in about 15 minutes. and that a man would have to put his soul at hazard in order to be part of the quote, the world, which I think is connected to the whole idea that money corrupts. But anyway, if you see this on Netflix and you don't see it on a Blu-ray, you are really missing the power of a lot of those shots. The other interesting thing I wanted to mention was that I have been in this part of Texas. The darks that they show you in the film are dark. There's a couple of really beautiful shots where it's at night and he's running into like the water, you know, and he's getting chased by the guys, and you just see that amazing sky with like the breaks of light kind of, because it's not quite dawn or it's the middle of the night. And I sat there and I was like, oh my God, I feel Texas. I mean, because I've been there, I could smell it. I could see it. There's shots where they especially do well where it's almost dusk, like when it's dusk or a little after dusk. Oh my God, that feels like a Texas night. Like I felt like I was back in Texas watching this. And that for me was the best part of this film. But anyway, I forgot how that tied into what we were talking about with the rooms. But I guess my confusion, because Nathan and I were kind of making fun of it. And Nathan's like, okay, first of all, any good thief knows that if you steal a bag of money, you take the fucking money out of the bag because there's probably a tracker in it. He goes, second thing, what the hell are you doing getting a hotel room if you suspect you're being followed like an hour away from your house? Like, are you an idiot? Like, I would just be like, okay, throw the shit in the car. I'm going to freaking Maine. Like, you know, and I mean, this movie's great, but there wouldn't be a movie if this guy had done those things.
Well, yeah, but keep in mind that though, this guy isn't a thief by trade. He just stumbled on this.
Well, and the point is he's a good man. I mean, you can see that he is a good man. Okay, his relationship with his wife is a little strange, but you do see that he does love her, and he takes his money because he wants a better life for them.
But he knows it's dumb. He even says it out loud at one point.
How stupid it is. Yep. Where'd you get the money? I got it from where'd you get the gun? I got it from the getting place, he says. He doesn't even want her to know where he got it from. Like, and I think that's what I'm saying about some of the themes in this movie. I think one of the themes is that we can want a better life and we can do stupid things to get that better life. But in the process, we sort of become bad, right? Because look, this guy gets guns and then he starts shooting things. I mean, he was a hunter anyway, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, he kind of goes a little sour.
Well, I don't think he did go sour. I think what it was is he stumbles upon the money. It's a lot of money. It will change his life and his wife's life and his mother-in-law's life forever. So he's obviously he decides to take the money instead of reporting it to the police. So what happens is he probably wouldn't have got caught even if there was a tracker in the bag, because the trackers only were like by a mile, if that. So it wasn't like modern day trackers where you can, you know, find someone like 30 miles away.
There wasn't GPS yet. It was 1980.
Exactly. So it was only if you just were near, it would start beeping. And since they didn't know who took the money, they probably would have never gone to his small town and found it. But it was when he had guilt, like you said, he's a good man. And he remembered that there was this one Mexican guy, drug dealer or not, that was wounded, that wanted water. He decides to go back that night. And then that's when he stumbles upon more gangsters because they happen to be there trying to find the money and to collect the drugs. And so that's when they find out who he is. And then that's when he has to bolt. And then
the
this
moral
whole
of the story is never have guilt and never help anybody.
There you go. And then also this movie only takes place in like a 2-day period, pretty much. So, or it's not like, you know, this is like a month and he got his wife out of the town and all that. And then fine. Okay. What's now I'm going to bolt straight to North Dakota. So and I have to agree with Eric, is that he's not a thief or a crook in general. So he doesn't know what to do anyway, because.
Well, it's also possible because he's hunting is pronghorn. And they used to be endangered. I think their populations are still controlled.
Mm-hmm.
So there's limits on hunting. So he might have been poaching the pronghorn in the first place.
Possible.
Which would make him obviously more reluctant to go to the police.
Yeah, because why else would he be out in that area? Yeah, that's true.
Well, he also shot one. You know, why are you there? Why'd you have a gun? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, because I just assumed it was illegal hunting, and so this probably took place in September or October, probably October or something. At least in this part of the country where I live, hunting season is like in October and stuff. So there's always warnings when I go to the woods with my dog not to go during hunting season. So that's why I know.
But, so I have another plot question.
Yeah, go on.
and maybe it's something that can't be answered. Maybe this dude's just that psycho. But when they go back out to the place where the deal went bad, and Anton Chigurh goes out there with those two guys, those are the guys that are hiring him, right?
Yeah, I didn't understand that. And then he shoots them? I didn't understand that.
I don't think they're the ones that were hiring him.
Well, then who were they?
That's a good question. He did steal their car, so he wanted their car. But why he killed them, I'm a bit confused too.
Exactly. And if they weren't the ones hiring him, why were they out there with him?
Oh, you know what? I'm thinking they were people. Basically, I think it was Stephen Root that hired him, and then he and these other two guys represented Stephen Root's character. And then when Chigurh killed them, that's when Stephen Root decided to hire Carson Wells.
And
my guess, right. Mike. Do you think that sounds right, Mike?
I think there were just two guys that were with him. I think they were just two other guys on the job. I don't.
But okay, so you don't think they were related to Stephen Root?
I think they probably were sent with him. So
yeah, I was under the impression that they were there to give him the lay of the land.
Right.
I don't know why he killed them.
Yeah, me neither. That was my question.
Right, because I'm sure they would have gave him the vehicle if he had asked, because he was hired by the same people as them, I thought, you know, by Stephen Root's guy. So, yeah, I was surprised that he killed them as well.
And while we're on it, what do you think happened to that guy in Stephen Root's office? Did he live?
Did you see me?
Yeah, and he did see him, so he's dead.
No, he said, "Do you see me?"
Which he right. does. So even if he yeah. said no, you know, like I didn't.
Yeah, I don't think it matters. But
yeah, I mean, there's some problems with this film because obviously, even if it's 1980, I assume the police office that he kills the cop at the beginning had cameras everywhere, and I assume the business office in downtown El Paso where Root's character was, or you know, had.
If cameras were common in 80,
you know, maybe not, but if you think about it, you would think they would at least been one camera at the front desk of the office building.
I'm pleading ignorance on this one. I don't know.
Yeah, well, cameras still
but I think it's an assumption.
Yeah, it is.
I don't know. I mean, these were a lot of the places they were at were rural places.
Maybe the cop station wouldn't have it, but because it's rural. But the office building, I would assume, would have. Because we see him going up the stairs. I mean, the office is overlooking the city. So there must have been a front entrance. But again, these are unanswered questions. They don't show him going in the building. Just show him entering out of the stairwell, you know?
Yeah, cameras were not as ubiquitous as they are now. Mm-hmm. I think especially when you're dealing with these motels, it would have been unusual. I don't even know if an office building, if it would have been that expected at the time. I mean,
Right. It's not a bank. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I was just looking here. This was on IMDb. And one of the questions was, why did he kill the two managerials at the drug deal gone bad? And just says he seems to like working alone is the best. Well, because he says you pick the one right tool, right? That was his line. You pick the one right tool, and he doesn't want these guys tagging along with him. The idea that he couldn't say, "Okay, I've got it from here," he is not all right in the head.
That's true.
Right. I mean, the thing that made me, there's a lot of things that made me know that he wasn't right in the head, but the one scene that felt a little weird was when he slows down at the bridge and he tries to shoot the crow.
Yeah, that's a little weird.
And that was
a symbolism thing, Christy?
Yes, that was definitely a symbolism thing.
And he missed.
He did. He missed.
Yeah.
But What did you get out of that scene? What was it there for? Because it was like, yeah, it was a screen. It was a scene to break scenes, you know, between two major scenes. But why would they choose that scene? And why would they have him shoot at a crow?
Well, I mean, we've talked about crows before. I think when we were actually talking about The Crow, you know, the movie. But crows, a lot of times, are symbols of bad luck and symbols of death. They can also be symbols of magic, mystery. In some religions and spiritual persuasions, they represent, you know, your loved ones who have crossed over. I think in this particular film, when he missed, I took it to be a bad omen, like just his own death was coming, that he missed it. In other words, he was never going to be able to defeat his own death. And as we see the silly mistakes that he's making throughout the film, that becomes more and more apparent that eventually he's going to get caught and he is going to die and he is not going to be able to escape his own fate. So when he missed shooting the crow, I took the crow as a symbol of death. And therefore, when he missed it, to me, it said when that happened, I went, oh, he's dead. Like, he's going to die. Like, I just knew he's not going to get out of this
deal. Well, as Tommy Lee Jones' character, Sheriff Bell, says an interesting line to his deputy about the Mexicans, that gangsters that were killed by Chigurh at that motel we were talking about where the satchel was hidden. And he says to the deputy, he goes,
natural causes.
Died of natural causes. And the deputy goes, what do you mean? I don't understand it. He goes, die of natural causes in the line of work that they do, which is gangsters. So this makes sense here because Anton Chigurh, no matter who he is and how brilliant of a hitman or money man or whatever he is, he's still living in a lifestyle that, you know, death is coming, which is probably getting shot down. And the life expectancy of a gangster that, I mean, I don't know what it is, but I can tell you it's probably smaller if you average it out than just a regular person that works a day job. So that would make sense, Chrissy, that it could mean that, yeah, his time is coming too.
Well, yeah, and it's also important, just a brief caveat here, is that when you see something in a film that you feel may be a symbol or represent something, it's important to consider that symbol in context of what you think the movie is trying to say. Well, something, for example, like The Crow, like we talked about, it can mean 50 million things. It just depends which spiritual system you're looking at. It depends whether or not if it's an animal or a bird, you know, are you looking at it from a totem perspective, which is completely different from being a symbol. Like if it's a totem animal or if it's just a symbol of something. So in that way, symbolism becomes very fluid and it's just going to say whatever it's going to say to you, but always consider it within the context of the film. Just because I got that out of it does not mean that is what the writers intended or what the Coen brothers intended or what anybody intended. I mean, for all we know, they could have been sitting around drunk and going, oh, hey, you know what would be cool here? How about if he shoots this bird and he misses? Whatever, like, because we need to kill 5 minutes in this movie, you know? So it's always important to just keep that in check. But
I think it also also foreshadows he missed his target.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yep. This is he is not going to get the man he's after.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Or at least not easily.
Well, and he does, and he doesn't, which is interesting. Earlier in the film, he sees the blood trail to track the pronghorn, right? And then it's repeated again, and he doesn't get the pronghorn. And then it's repeated again when he shoots at Chigurh, and he follows the blood trail, and he doesn't get Chigurh. So that's actually repeated twice.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because he doesn't get the pronghorn. Am I right? Or am I crazy?
Right.
Did I miss something?
Well, yeah.
So the whole business with the pronghorn is actually foreshadowing, if you think about it.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
So, switching gears, how awesome is that fucking bolt gun?
It is pretty cool. It is. Pretty
I
cool.
told Nathan I really need one of those. I really do.
Just to walk around those, like, punch out any lock you want to. That'd be sweet.
Yeah, that won't work in real life, though.
Yeah.
Well, you know what's funny is that.
Stop it, scientist ruining.
Well,
everything.
No. So yeah, Chrissy can't get one. Chrissy's saying she wants one.
I want one.
She's gonna be severely disappointed.
Well, actually, the interesting thing is, you know, this is where it comes in handy that my husband was a farmer. Because the second in the beginning of the film when we see the guy with the tank and the thing, and he's like, oh, he's got some kind of oxygen tank. My husband goes, oh, that's what we use to kill the cows.
Right.
I went, what? And he goes, yeah, it's this blah, blah, blah. And he explains the whole thing and how it works. So that when Tommy Lee Jones came along later and kind of explained it, Nathan was like, see, I told you. Yeah. And they really are awesome like that. He's like, you can do all kinds of shit with that. We really need one around here. I was like, okay, so can you get me one like for my birthday? That would be great. So
no, I knew that there was a bolt gun they used to put cows down, but I thought it was stationary. I thought it like stayed in the barn at the place where they kill the cows and it's hooked up to some system in there. And you're bringing the cows to it. I didn't realize it was portable, and that's pretty cool.
Well, apparently there is a pot that you can – I did not ask him about this, but if Nathan recognized that that's what it is immediately, then it must be something that's available or something that was possibly modified. What I do know from my husband's having grown up on a farm is that there's an awful lot of poverty – and that, therefore, there is an awful lot of improvisation with certain things. So, you know, maybe somebody can't afford the big machine, so they go out and figure out a way to make it out of other parts, which is possible. I will ask him about that, though, Eric, and I'll message you after I get the answer.
The classic film Texas Chainsaw Massacre, they talk all about it in the, yep, in the car scene.
The first time you see it, when he escapes and then pulls that random dude over to steal his car, I mean, obviously the guy has no idea what it is, and most people wouldn't. I mean, if I saw, I mean, having seen this movie, I'd be a little suspicious at this point. Somebody starts walking onto my car with a tank in one hand and a hose in the other. I'm hitting the gas.
Could you please get out of the car, sir?
Get out of the car. And he's just like, remain still. Yeah. Oh, shoot.
Poor bastard.
Yep. He had no idea what was coming.
Nothing. Had no idea. It shows you can't trust anybody. And then the poor chicken farmer. Could you please take all those crates out of the truck, please?
What?
I'm sorry, sir. And you know what's going to happen to that poor bastard. So it shows you don't ever help anybody. Jesus. But again, right? I mean, the black guy that picks up Llewellyn says, man, someone your age should not ever be hitchhiking.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it just shows you, you know, it's a can't trust
people.
But
there's irony in that too, right? In that, you know, if you hitchhike, you're going to get yourself in trouble. And of course, the problem is he's already in much, much worse trouble than he'll probably ever get from hitchhiking.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
Indeed.
Oh, I just love popping out the lock cores too. That was just such an awesome thing in this movie. And when he finally tracks down Llewellyn, when Llewellyn's sitting there waiting for him, and he pops the core out and it just hits him right in the chest, and he's just like, sweet.
Also, what was awesome too is later when Tommy Lee Jones is talking to the local police chief, and the police chief says, back in at that hotel downtown, he murders the desk clerk, and imagine that the next day he comes back at the crime scene and then he murders a U.S. colonel. Who goes back to a crime scene the next day?
And
you know, and it's like it just shows us this guy's got some balls. And I tell you one thing about Shiger too is that he had it all. Again, like you, Mike, you said, there's something off besides just principle, because he kills Carson Wells, and then he picks up the phone when Llewellyn calls, and he says, "You know who I am," and all that. And he goes, "I know where the money is. It's off to the side of the river," because Carson Wells had just mentioned it. "And I know it's where you are. You're at the hotel across the river," because again, Carson Wells had mentioned that. He goes, "But I'm not coming to the hotel, and I'm not coming to get the money. You know where I'm going." Mm-hmm. He goes, and basically he's going to the wife, mm-hmm, to take her out. And the only way he says he's going to stop is if you just come here to me with the money, because I'm not coming to you, and I'm not coming to get the money on the side of the river. If you don't come, I'm going to kill your wife. This is the best deal I can give you. Mm-hmm. And Llewellyn says, "Fuck you," just as Carson Wells had just said a couple of minutes before. And then, of course, we know what happens. But the thing is that every character in this movie, besides Tommy Lee Jones' character, who's a defeatist, every character in this movie has guts. They stare death straight into the Grim Reaper's eyes, and they don't give a damn. And whether it's Llewellyn, whether it's Chigurh, whether it's Carson Wells.
Even the guy in the gas station, even though he didn't know he was doing it.
That's true. Yeah, exactly. And so I felt that was kind of interesting, that all these characters had guts. That there was no like reasoning. They just had this one track mind, which is, this is the way it's going, and that's it.
Yeah.
And the thing that's funny too is, like we said, is that Llewellyn does eventually get taken out, but it ain't by Chigurh. It's by the Mexicans.
Right.
And the Mexicans weren't able to get the money because it was a big gunfight, and the cops were coming. And then, of course, Chigurh goes back later, and he's the one that gets the money. So he quote-unquote, wins in a sense. And then he wins again, because then he gets in his car, and he drives to Odessa, mm-hmm, to meet the wife and finish that deal, too, which is what he told he was going to do when he spoke to Llewellyn.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, that's where Tommy Lee Jones' character just doesn't understand it. And when he talks to the sheriff, the local police chief again, he says, "I don't understand a person like this." And I think that's what makes him finally say, "Enough's enough." And that's why he quits.
He retires, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it's like you say, Chrissy, it goes, it's set piece after set piece after set piece after set piece, each scene. And like you said that too, Mike, which is basically, there's no moments that are slow, and even when it's slow, it's interesting. You know, like when he's trying.
Well, it's to it has slow moments, but it doesn't have boring moments.
Right.
It's beautifully paced, and you know they build up. There are scenes like at the hotel room, you know, where they, or just even the conversations between Chigurh and his potential victims, where they just crank up the tension so much.
Oh my god, that scene at the gas station is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Because they're just, the guy's just chit-chatting at this counter, and the whole thing goes so south so fast. He's just standing there like, oh my god, what's happening?
For no reason, except that Chigurh is insane. Because
right, and it's
chit-chat, like, so I see you coming from Dallas. What's it about?
What business is it of yours?
Right, and if you've ever worked retail, sometimes you have those conversations with a customer,
uh-huh,
where you say something and they take it the completely wrong,
absolutely,
way. It's just idle chit chat. And know what this reminded me of again? I just now think is the scene in Goodfellas. You know, what do you mean I'm funny? You know, it's just an innocent remark,
uh-huh,
that the psychopath takes completely the wrong way. And that's what happens to the guy at the gas station. And even the thing, he said, "Don't put it in your pocket."
At the end, he's just standing there with a coin in his hand, like, what the fuck just happened?
That is your lucky coin. Don't put it in your pocket, because it'll just be mixed in with the rest of your change. It just becomes another coin.
Which it is.
Which it is. That was awesome. And the guy's like, what the fuck? Oh, the best, too. He goes, no, this was my wife's place. Oh, so you married into it.
If that's the way you want to put it.
Yeah.
No, it's not what I'm putting. That's how it is.
That's how it is. Yes.
That was awesome. In the actor that plays the gas attendant, mm-hmm, did an awesome psychopath role himself a year or two later. Well, 10 years later, he played the religious kook in
Sacrament?
The Sacrament, exactly.
Oh, okay. I knew he looked familiar.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, he was awesome in that. So he's a good actor. And yet he does, and if you look at his IMDb, Bailey has any roles.
Oh, yeah, even the bit parts in this movie were spectacular. There's that guy, and then there's the lady at the other hotel. She played her role quite well.
Oh, the one about don't you want
but
the room?
But that one has two bad.
Yeah.
But everybody, I mean the deputy's assistant or the sheriff's assistant, you know, mm-hmm. they're his wife. There's you know even
the chicken coop guy. He was awesome.
Yeah, they're all great. And this is
the
again
mother-in-law.
Yeah, the mother-in-law. Oh, she was awesome. Yep.
Now I'm going to El Paso, and I got the cancer.
Well, I like that. He says on the phone, everything will be fine. It ain't going to be fine. I got the cancer.
That's right in the background. That was awesome. And she goes, why do you want to speak to whatever the wife's name is? He goes, it doesn't matter. But, and then he goes, she goes, yeah, but it's early. It's after breakfast. Or something like that. He goes, it's going, fine. I'll get her.
Well, and then when they're trying to track him, when the guy comes up and the mother-in-law is like, you don't often see a Mexican in a suit.
That's right.
But even
kind of thing to say out loud.
No, but even the Mexican in the suit was good.
He was good. He was great.
But this is a good example of, you know, what we've always said, which is that you don't have to get big names to get good actors. There is a ton of good actors out there. You know, and you can go beat local community theater and probably find a good actor here or there if all you're looking for.
Well, Mike, a good example of that was The Mist, where like 90% of the actors in that were all local New Orleans actors. And a bunch of them have since that movie have become pretty big Hollywood character actors. So you're absolutely right. You can find a lot of great actors just, you know, locally nobodies. Until the this film, like he did here. But the Coen brothers did here, where they just found these great actors, most of them probably local, that just hit it out of the ballpark, and they were small parts too. You know, I mean, the chicken coop guy, when he's going, what airport would you go out of? Well, do you mean an airstrip or do you mean an airport?
Right.
You know, and he goes, an airport. Well, I think you would probably want to head to El Paso. And we know what's going on. He's just trying to figure out where Llewellyn would go. And that's why he's asking the questions, not because he really wants to go to the airport. And the whole scene is great because the guy's clueless and he's just, the Good Samaritan helping out a guy that appears to need a jump. You know, and so,
the moral of the story is never help anybody.
Right. Oh, and what about the scene where Belle goes to see his uncle at the end? In the wheelchair. He's a well-known character actor. He was awesome too.
Right. Was he the uncle? I couldn't figure out
every week. Yeah, even if there's some left over.
He's the uncle. And he goes. So if you ever found out who shot you, basically put him in a wheelchair, what would you do? And he basically says, well, it's been so long. I don't think it really matters anymore. I've already forgotten about it.
What if they let him out?
Yeah, I wouldn't let it burn me. I don't want to let it burn me and, kill me or whatever. You know, having rage and anger and revenge and all
rage.
That. Rage! That scene was awesome, too. And that was the one scene when I first saw the film, I was completely confused what was going on. And then when I rewatched it multiple times this week, it completely makes sense. And it really pretty much is the cherry for what the movie's trying to say, basically. All the roles were great. I mean, that's the thing about this film. It's just loaded with everything. And the surround sound, when I was listening to it, it's perfect.
It's a good sound design.
Yeah, it sure is. I mean, especially when he was out at the antelopes and then the dogs chasing him in the river. I mean, it was awesome.
Oh, yeah, they killed a dog. That was...
But they're bad.
It was justified.
Bad dogs. That's right.
He was a bad dog.
That's right. He ain't no John Wick dog. He's a bad dog.
Right.
There's that dog at the beginning, right? He spies through the binoculars, like limping away. You know, that is sort of foreshadowing his future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Because he's limping right from the moment he gets chased by the Mexicans at the and the dog, he gets shot there by a shotgun, and then Shigura shoots him at that hotel downtown. And he's that's him. I mean, so
yeah, I was reading Josh Brolin, apparently right before they were going to start shooting, he was on motorcycle and he gets into a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, as he's flipping over the car that hit him, he's thinking, shit, I finally got a part in a Coen Brothers movie and now I'm going to lose it because he got injured. And he busted his shoulder and it was, that's okay. That's, you get shot in that at the beginning of the movie.
There you go. And you know what's funny is that Dillahunt, who plays the deputy sheriff, was the guy that wanted that role, and he lost out to the role, and then they gave him the deputy sheriff.
Mm.
Yeah. And Dillahunt was probably best known to genre fans as the lead villain in the Last House of the Left remake.
He's also got a starring role now in Fear the Walking Dead. He's been since the start of the fourth season.
Oh my God,
is that show still on?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, most people say it's better than the original now. They flip-flop.
I said most.
I'm not saying
anyway.
That you. Yeah,
no anyway. Country for old men.
Yeah, let's stay on no good.
I was just saying.
So basically, we didn't even set up. We're assuming everybody has already seen the film. That's the reason why we're talking about Nova.
And anybody over 30.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so basically what it is there's this psycho named Anton Chigurh, most likely either American or an American immigrant from Eastern Europe, based off of what I've read.
He's a freak.
He is already after the money at the beginning of the film. And what happens is Llewellyn is this guy, a mechanic. No, he's a welder who stumbles upon all these dead people in the middle of the desert, because obviously it was a drug deal that went bad. He takes the money, and when he wakes up in the middle of the night, he feels guilty. He heads back because there was one guy that was still alive that wanted water, and when he goes back, the Mexicans are already there collecting the dope, and so he has to bolt. And then Stephen Root's guys show up with Shigur. And since the Mexicans popped all his tires to his car and he had to run, basically walk home through the desert, his truck's still there. And Shakur gets the ID, the PIN number from the car, and then traces it back to him. And now his family's on the run.
By the way, just a note, I don't know anything about drug prices or inflation, but it seems to me the entire flatbed and truck full of heroin would be worth possibly more than $2 million.
Yeah, I mean, definitely nowadays.
1980.
Yeah, so, that's why I mentioned inflation. I don't know how that all works, but that's an awful lot of heroin.
It is. Because, yeah, it was like a whole truckload of it, like a pickup truckload of it. One thing that I found...
Do we know if he actually counted the money?
He never counted the money because he would have found the tracer.
Yeah.
Well, no, the bills were wrapped, so he could have just said, you know, 10,000, 100,000, you know, counted it that way.
Yeah, well, that's true. Every one was 10,000, every little packet, yeah.
Right. Well, except for the one that had the tracer.
Right, that's right.
Which I think that, because those were singles, right, which, by the way, that was a nice touch.
I loved that. That was really cool.
Then he cut the holes in the singles for the tracer. But still, you think that the Mexicans or whoever it was that was receiving the money, you know, would have been unhappy about the fact that there were some bills missing.
Well, that's why it was a drug deal that went wrong, because there was one person already there to rip off the other.
Right.
So they must have discovered that they were being ripped off, and that's when the gunfight happened. Because the gunfight happens off screen before the movie even starts.
Yeah, we never know how that all went down. Yeah.
But
and we don't need to.
But based off of what we find out and what Tommy Lee Jones' character says later, it's basically a drug deal that goes wrong, and most likely someone must have found the tracer or something else that was off, and then that's when everybody killed themselves. Also, I like that the sheriff's deputy wasn't a moron, because he was the one that says it looks like there's two different murders here. There was the assassination of the suits here, and then over there was Wild West.
Well, he was a little bit of a moron.
Well, he wasn't as like, smart when they're in the one
place, and he's like, "Oh God, we just missed him. We gotta get this out on the radio." And Tommy Lee Jones is like, "Okay, and exactly what are we gonna circulate? Looking for somebody who recently drank milk?"
I wouldn't call that stupid. I would just call it overly excited.
Maybe. It was a funny line, though.
It was
very funny. I really love that.
I love the running joke of the DEA agents. You know, the DEA agents are back. It's like, do you want to go out there? Are there more dead bodies? Well, no, I don't think I need to. It was just like, I learned what I needed to. I don't need to go back out there.
And then the running line about the dead dog. That's a dead dog. It sure is. and then when the cops show up, the sheriff show up, they go, "Oh my God, they even killed the dog."
So that
was a running joke as well, kind of. But yeah, the DEA, that was great. It's like, who cares about the DEA? They're just finding everything we already found.
Right.
You know, and do they need me there? Are they find anything else new? No, then I don't have to go.
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. Oh, and then how about when the flatbed truck is driving with all the corpses and he has to pull them over. He goes, "You got to let the bodies fall out. Did you lose any yet?"
Oh, that would be, if you were driving behind that truck, that would be awful.
Make sure you cover them up.
All of a sudden, somebody falls off the back of the truck. You might be able to tell they're dead in between the time they hit the pavement and you run over them. But maybe not.
Yeah. So do you think Tommy Lee Jones was walking away going, "Goddamn millennials don't even know how to tie a body in the back of the trunk"?
Well,
that was 1980, so that would have been more like, you know.
Right, but it's you understand my point.
Yeah,
idea that everybody complains about, "Oh, these fucking kids today don't know how to properly tie down the tarp on the back of a truck."
Uh-oh. Right. And the thing is back in those days, you have to pull people over or whatever because no one has cell phones. So you can't just call them up and go, "Hey, dude, you gotta tighten those bodies back," you know?
Cell phones ruined a whole bunch of shit.
They did.
Yeah. They really did. And actually, it's interesting that you say that because I have often thought that what has made especially my life more interesting as a horror writer or whatever, as a short story writer, is that it presents problems for both, you know, screenwriters and for, you know, short fiction writers and stuff, because now we have to deal with this idea that everybody has the ability to be in contact at all times, which is why that trope of cell phone has no service is so terrible. But I also think what's cool is that because of this, you're starting to get a lot more timeless sort of stories, both in film and in short fiction, or they're set in a particular time period before the era of the cell phone. So I think what's happening is, like I said, we're getting a lot of timeless things. Like, right, Phil, like It Follows, where you're not really freaking sure.
Right, yeah.
What time you're in.
That was just what I was thinking of.
But
there's others that I've seen. There are movies that I've seen recently, and I can't think of them now, but they weren't set in a particular time period, but they just didn't even deal with the idea of a cell phone. It just never came up.
Right.
And I think that's actually a much better way of handling things, because then years from now, when the technology changes, there's no issue. Like, you're watching the story for the story instead of sitting there going, "Oh my God, well, that dude had a cell phone. Like, why didn't he just call?" Like, you know what I mean? And that kind of ruins stuff.
Well, you know that's a great segue to the source material, because when this film came out, I never even heard of Cormac McCarthy, who was born in Providence, Rhode Island, by the way, but he grew up in Tennessee. New England.
Maybe he can come to the Dark Discussions meetup.
There you go. But what was interesting was when, so I decided to read the book, and then you find out the book was literally 2 years before the movie. So the book was already a bestseller, which I hadn't heard of, I guess, in 2005. And then 2 years later, they make the film. I just assumed the book was from 1980. You know, so it was amazing to see that they were adapting a brand new book, basically, when in fact, based off of what we see on screen, it makes it, being a period piece, you think it's probably an old book, and they just didn't update it to modern era, you know? And so I thought that was kind of cool.
I do think you get into, and then we'll get back to the movie, but I do think you get into a real issue. I went to a conference once, and they were all sitting around at this table, and they were talking about, these were writers, and they're like, well, my agent said I really need to go in and update my backlist. And then somebody asked her, this person, to clarify, and she goes, well, you know, these books are old because I wrote them in the 80s and, you know, early 90s before cell phones and modern technology. And so I was told that I should really take these books and you know, in order to be able to keep them relevant, update them with modern technology. And I was like, oh, my God. Because I was like, you know what? I think we should really update Moby Dick then, too, because, you know, nobody whales like that anymore. Like, what? Do you know what I'm saying? So I think there's a danger here in keeping things too relevant or being tempted to go back and update them, because it loses something when you do that.
Right.
Leave it where it is, you know?
And that's what the Coen brothers did. They left it in 1980.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, well, and you knew it was 19. It was great how they let you know it was 1980, because they don't say it anywhere. But what happens is during that,
it's the coin, the coin toss thing. It was so brilliant. I was like, oh my God, that is so cool, because I didn't honestly realize it was set in 1980 until they did the coin thing.
Exactly. So you caught that too. That was brilliant.
Yeah, it was awesome. I was like, wait a minute, it's 1980? But that just goes to show you how timeless it is. Now, granted, had I paid more attention to the types of freaking trucks and cars they were driving, I would have noticed. But then again, you're talking about an area of Texas that's very desolate. And, you know, you are going to see, okay, maybe not cars from the 80s, because those cars are really wicked old now, and probably a lot of them don't run unless they're classics, but older vehicles. So you're not necessarily going to bat an eyelash if you see a bunch of older cars out in the middle of the desert. That's just kind of the way it is out there. So,
yeah. What about Chigurh's shotgun or whatever it was? Because that was an unbelievable gun.
Well, it's unbelievable because it wasn't real.
I would love to know what it was.
It was a shotgun. It just had a silencer on it, which didn't exist until like 2014.
I was going to say, is that even a thing
for shotguns?
Yeah.
Okay. But also that it was so accurate. It was shot like a rifle,
mm-hmm.
which was the thing that made me wonder, is it a shotgun or is it a rifle?
Well, he's just really good.
Well, the one he had when he took out Carson Wells, I think was a shotgun. I think he had some form of sniper gun, though, because when he was going after Llewellyn, after he tracked him down with the transmitter, that seemed like single bullets that he was firing.
Okay.
Right, like that. Shot
when he was in the pickup truck, right?
Right. That was single bullets, because it was just I don't know that a shotgun would have killed a man at that distance going through.
Right.
Yeah. Through safety glass.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because when he took out when Chigurh was on the second floor or third floor of that hotel, and he shoots Llewellyn.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. That couldn't have been a shotgun. So he must have had two different guns.
Yeah.
Well, and I just kind of assumed, with all the various different gun stuff. Now, I'm not well versed in guns. My husband is, but I'm not. I just kind of assumed that this guy was obviously a professional killer. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times these guys get guns and they can modify them or mess with them or take pieces of, I don't know, three or four other different guns and build new ones out of them that specifically serve their
like choppers.
Purpose.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's a fair point.
Yeah, but I know, because I do know people that do that. They kind of build their own guns. They play with different things. They order parts online. They put them together. I mean, I do know people who do that.
It's like Jesse James with motorcycles.
So, I mean, I wasn't even worried if anything looked a little weird to me, because I was like, well, he's a professional. He probably messes with his own stuff and builds it to his own specific purpose.
And the most important part is that it was cool as hell.
Whose motorcycle
it was,
is this?
Cool, but it was huge. I kept wondering where the hell he was keeping it. I guess in his car.
He was just walking around with it. He just walked through the lobby of that hotel with it. Nobody noticed.
It's also Texas.
True.
All right.
Open carry.
Yeah.
Right. Well. That's the thing. It's like when the chief later says, "Who goes back to the crime scene the next day?" You know, and he had just killed the desk guy the day before, and then he goes back to kill Carson Wells. You know, it's like nuts. Walking right through the.
Right.
Well, and then what's his
Let's
name?
Let's go to your room.
Well, and then Llewellyn, right? He's walking to the motel, and the girl's, you know, flirting with him at the pool, and she knows that he has a gun, has a shotgun, because it's in the bag, but it's a bag specifically for a gun, and she says, "Oh, you going hunting or something like that?" And so yeah, it's like you said, it's Texas. People just have guns to walk around.
Yep.
No big deal. This ain't New York where everybody just shoots everybody. So, and when I say New York, I mean New York City, Mark, not.
Yeah, but actually, it's still relatively low rates of gun violence for New York City.
Yeah, we're
not in the Dinkin era anymore.
that's true. That's a good point. Yeah. So what else? Did we miss? Our scenes that we haven't talked about that are awesome, because there's a lot of awesome scenes.
Well, we didn't talk a lot about Woody Harrelson and Carson Wells.
Yep, Carson Wells.
And I like that character quite a bit. Again, he doesn't do a lot in the movie. He's kind of just there as yet one more person thrown on the path of Llewellyn Moss, and another obstacle for Anton Chigurh. But he's a completely different kind of killer, and you know, same line of business. But he's the more rational one. He's the one you want on your tail rather than Chigurh, because he's good.
Yeah, and he's more like a Bill Bondsman rather than an assassin.
Right, and they don't go through, well, how did he track him down? How did he find him? You know, but I like the fact that they, you know, like the scene in the hospital. He says, you know, it took me how many hours to find you?
Three hours.
Yeah, it took me 3 hours to find you. I said, well, because of the tracer. He's like, no, it wasn't the tracer.
It's like, you're just that easy to find, so stop fucking around here.
Yeah, we're fucking professionals. We're good at what we do.
He's
gonna find you.
Right, and then he finds the bag, right? The satchel, and so he goes back to the hotel to probably switch his boots to, you know, boots that can go in the mud. But of course, he doesn't, because Anton Chigurh is there.
I loved his final conversation with Anton Chigurh, because first he's trying to weasel his way out of it, and then he realizes who he's talking to, and he just says, "Do you have any idea how crazy you are?"
That was awesome.
And he's like, "You mean the nature of this conversation?" He goes, "No, I mean the nature of you."
I was shocked that because I thought they were like weren't. They didn't hate it. I didn't think he would kill him. I thought it was more like just rivals, but not like violent.
Oh,
rivals.
Yeah. When he shot him, I was like, damn, that sucks. I was really into Woody Harrelson. What the fuck?
Well, this gets back to the conversation with Stephen Root, right? Is that you pick one tool for the job. You know, is that he's been hired, and it's an insult to him that you hired other people to do what he was hired to do.
Right.
You know, and so he kills the other Mexicans or the other guys that were there to get Moss. They kills he kills Woody Harrelson, because they keep hiring people thinking that Chigurh is gone rogue when he hasn't. He's just trying to do his fucking job, and he's a psychopath.
Right, but they're right, and they think he. Well, that's the thing. Once he kills the other two business guys at the drug bus, the drug deal gone bad. I think that's when Root's character said, "All right, this guy's gone rogue. I got to bring in Carson Wells." And then, you know, for Segura, he doesn't look at it that way because he's insane. But for everybody else, they're saying, "Okay, he's gone rogue." But in fact, he wasn't. He didn't go rogue. He was eventually going to bring the money probably back to the Root's character. But by the time Wells is hired, he's pissed and he kills Wells, and then he goes and kills Root because of what Root had hired other people to do the job. So, at least that's what I got out of it.
Yeah.
Because why else would he have gone back to kill Root, right? Because it wasn't like Root was after him necessarily. You know,
and Root was just, in all likelihood, just a middleman, right? You know, he's the guy that's hiring the guy that hires the guys, you know,
He seemed like more of a lawyer or something that was in the middle that was hiring, helping the Mexican guys find their American counterpart type of deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree, Mike.
But even stuff like they do little things like, you know, when he's talking to Steve, you know, I counted the number of floors in this building, and there's one missing, you know, which is a neat little just joke to throw in there for people, which I know, I assume that was, you know, the 13th floor.
13th floor, yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, and then the other good line from the joke from that scene was, I have a pocket. Yeah, could you validate my pocket? Yeah, when he was just given a credit card that would give him $1,500 every day. You know, so and he's asking for $2 to be validated or whatever. It was kind
of right,
funny.
which is of course higher from the last time. You know, from the previous $1,000.
Oh, what do you mean?
He says that. He says, you know, it's $1,200. That's an increase of, you know, from $1,000. Yeah. So he's just, you know, reminding him that the price has gone up. But it's just little things they do, like him remembering the exact date, you know, pointing out
that was
to
awesome. Yeah, November quickly, something.
28th.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Pointing out how quickly he found Llewellyn Moss. Just all stuff to show you he's smart and he's good and he's competent at the job without actually having to show you actually doing his job.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm actually looking up right now if Thanksgiving was 1980 was the 28th, or or if he was really is a man that knows his days, because he claims that he knows his days, right? Mm-hmm. And Thanksgiving that was November 27th, so it was the day after. So you know, if you really want to look at it, maybe the reason he remembers Segura was because he knew it was, you know, you don't forget the day after Thanksgiving necessarily, right? Versus say some, you know, August 12th or something. But yeah, you're right. Those little lines were pretty good, and I liked how Root's character was like confused, like, oh, so you know dates, and basically the point was is when it's related to Segura, you know, you remember. You know, you gonna say something, Eric?
I was just gonna say another scene we didn't really hit on, the first scene of the movie, which is when he escapes, and what I was mentioning at the beginning about him always being like no sense of urgency and kind of having a calm about him. That is about the most relaxed I've ever seen anybody be while strangling somebody else to death. He's just like, don't, you know, don't. Did he stop moving yet? No. All right. Don't, you know, don't. Yeah.
Oh, and Eric, the detail they go into when, you know, you see the body later and you see all the marks from mm-hmm. his boots mm-hmm. on the floor, and you know, just things like that, that an amateur director wouldn't think of.
Yeah.
And you know, they were thinking of everything, which is, you know, the true details of the scene, which is when the guy's flipping out and scratching on the linoleum floor, his mm-hmm. boots are making the black marks on the floor, and,
yeah.
just stuff like that. So yeah, that was awesome. And then when he takes off his handcuffs to mm-hmm. leave,
the bruises.
Yeah, it's the bruises. So it doesn't forget any details. It's just brilliant. Mm-hmm. The whole movie is just brilliant. Like that. Let's see what else.
So what about Tommy Lee Jones' little speech at the end of the movie?
Oh, you mean not with his uncle, but with his wife?
With his wife, talking about his dream.
Yeah. I think, you know what it is? There was two. It says, and this actually comes right from the book too, I think. But he says he had two dreams the previous night. One was both related to his father. One was he met up with his father downtown and gave him some money, whatever that means. And then that's maybe that's like the ferryman. And then the second dream was really his father was his father. He went to see his father out in the desert or something, and his father was waiting for him or something like that.
Well, he said that he gave him money and he lost it.
Okay.
And my guess is that has to do with because he said he took over the job of sheriff after his father.
No, his father
or something like that.
His father and him, based off the beginning speech, the very beginning of the movie, the monologue at the beginning, his father and he were both sheriffs at the same time from different.
That's right.
Counties, yeah.
That's right, but it was still the idea that he passed. You can get the. I would take the idea that he passed the mantle on to him, and he's feeling like he hasn't been able to that he's ending his job as a failure.
Right.
Doesn't solve the. Solve the crime here,
right?
You know that he doesn't retrieve the money that everybody was chasing after.
Well, and nor does he protect Llewellyn, which was also right. A goal of his.
Well, Llewellyn was already dead at that point, right?
He was on his way to find him and protect him because his wife told him where he was.
Right.
Right, but also
that's why he was at that hotel.
But the wife's sister-in-law had already, I mean, the wife's. His mother-in-law had already told the Mexicans where he was.
Yeah, but
they didn't know that.
Yeah, the whole thing from the beginning has been a race to get to Llewellyn Moss and protect him and either kill him or protect him.
Right.
You know, and he lost the race badly.
He did. Yeah. Oh, and oddly, it wasn't Shigura that got him. It was the other group, the Mexican
right.
side that
mm-hmm.
got him.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so what did the two dreams mean, though, is what Eric's trying to say.
And
so
then
one,
the second thing is to me that he's waiting for him to die, you know, that
right,
he's in
right.
darkness.
And he'll
you know,
see his father.
And he's waiting for him to arrive there.
Yeah.
You know, and he makes the comment, I don't know, write it down. But it goes, the idea that it's a rough world, you know, that it'll... that's sorry, not a rough world, but it's a rough country, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's shoot, I can't see what I guess I didn't write it down.
All right.
Oh, what you got ain't nothing new. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that I mean that's he's trying to say the world's changed, and it isn't the world is changing. You're just getting old.
Right.
You know, people there have always been horrible people doing horrible things. There's not, you know, and you have that story he tells earlier on about the case. He said, well, I was going to murder somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know what this world is coming to, but those people have always kind of been there.
Right.
You know, it
right.
just, we see it differently. We romanticize it as we're growing up.
Yeah.
And at some point the world that, you know, we don't have the ability to deal with the world anymore. He also said, it's not your responsibility. You can't stop the future from coming.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, we all have this thing where we all think, or we like to think, that we're the indispensable person at our jobs.
Right.
You know.
Right. Right. Right.
And yet, you will one day leave that job.
And then a year later, no one will remember you.
And yeah, you're either going to leave it standing up or you're going to leave it laying down. But you will leave that job, and the odds are really good the business will continue. That, mm-hmm. you know. That if that you will be replaced, you know,
the grave. What was that great line? The graveyard. If you're looking for a bunch of indispensable people, just look at the graveyard.
Yeah,
right.
You know, because we're just being replaced every generation.
And that's it.
Yeah.
And the number of truly indispensable people are very, 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 very few.
This
you know,
conversation is getting depressing. Quickly.
But that's the movie.
That's the movie.
You know, that's the movie.
It's not about a drug deal going bad and $2 million. It's what Mike's talking about.
It's about life sucks. Don't help anybody.
Well, it's not saying don't help anybody because
that's what I'm saying. Watch this movie. It teaches you that lesson. Don't help anybody. Bad things happen when you help people.
No, I think there's a lot of people that help Llewellyn along the way. You know,
not many of them have good things happen to them.
Well, yeah, but that's not their fault. That's because Llewellyn fucked up. Actually, most of them, like, nothing happens to the guy who gives him a ride.
Right.
You know, nothing happens to the store owner.
Yeah, but the desk clerk and the...
nothing
The guy that helped Anton Chigurh at the side of the road.
Well, but that's also ties into the fate of Anton Chigurh, right? Is the idea and the whole thing with the coin.
No, you're not listening to me. The lesson is never help anybody.
Yeah, sure. And yet... Well, and here's the question. Is it really random? I mean, the idea he talks about, you know, all the events needed for that coin to end up in your hands. You know, that's an emphasis of sort of the idea of randomness and chance and dumb luck. And yet at the same time, he ends up getting plowed over by a car at the end of the film.
Right,
you know,
right.
And is that karma for him being a shit?
Well, and that's actually, I was doing some reading on Wikipedia earlier, and apparently one of the actual themes that was intended in this movie is how Anton Chigurh is trying to displace responsibility by using the coin and not taking responsibility for his own actions and trying to put everything in fate's hands. And that's one of the themes of the story is whether or not we have control over our own destiny or whether it's all fate.
Well, and that's interesting too, because Chigurh is insane because like the clerk at the gas station, all he had to do was say, yeah, I'm coming from Dallas and pay his thing and say, have a good day. And that's it. But
he's
such a evil bastard that he gets pissed at the guy and he says, okay, I want to kill this guy. So he wants to flip the coin. And the thing is, it's like you said, it's him trying to not have the responsibility of killing him. It's the guy's own good luck or bad luck that he's getting killed. And yet everybody keeps on telling Chigurh, whether it's Carson Wells, whether it's Llewellyn's wife, that you don't have to do this.
Right.
Right.
It's all bullshit. You're a fucking asshole.
Right. But the same thing you could say for Llewellyn, right? Because his wife says many times, well, this is just who he is.
Right.
You know, he is who he is. He didn't have to take the money.
Right.
Yep.
He didn't have to go. And by the way, he also didn't have to go back and try to give the guy water.
Right.
Right.
You know, there's any number of places along the way.
Again, when you help people, bad things happen.
Well, but it also reminds me, there was an old Woody Woodpecker cartoon where he gets into some sort of trouble and things just keep spiraling out of control. And every couple of minutes, somebody steps off the side of the screen and says, if Woody had only stopped.
Yeah, I remember that one. Yeah, that's a
none of this ever would have happened. And it's just a running joke throughout the film. And he's Woody, and Llewellyn is Woody Woodpecker. If he had just gone to the police. Any one of 100 times through the story, he would have survived. His wife would have survived. He would have been safe. He would have lost the money, but he would be alive.
Right.
You know, his wife wouldn't have been widowed and then probably murdered.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Well, she was murdered because he Chigurh is wiping his feet with blood after he leaves the house.
Probably.
Yeah. But my guess is that. All he had to do, if he was really felt that guilty about leaving the Mexican guy without water that was wounded, is he could have just gone to a payphone and given an anonymous tip to the cops, and they would, you know. But he didn't do that because he didn't think ahead, and, you know. Because the smart thing wouldn't have gone back to give the money to give the guy water, because you're going right back to a crime scene that you know someone eventually is going to come to, especially when there was drugs there. All you do is you go down the street or go, you know, drive 10 miles away to three towns over and you go to the first payphone. You say, I'm calling it a tip. They can't trace it because it's just to a payphone. And that's it.
Here's the other interesting thing about that situation, which is, I don't know about you guys, but if I ever am out and about and run across a whole mess of dead bodies, I'm not sticking around to investigate.
Right.
he's poking around, checking out that he finds the guy in the truck that wants the water. Then he's like, there had to have been the last guy standing. Who was he? Where did he go? And he goes looking for that money. And that's really where he got him. So if he had just gotten the hell out of there and called the cops, been like, there's a whole bunch of dead people over there, click.
Well, you know what? At least for someone like him, even though he's as Chrissy said, a fairly decent man, he's living in a fabricated home, doesn't have a high paying job, doesn't have many things. Money tempts him, and therefore, it was hard for him to just run away and then call the cops about it. That's why he wanted to get the money.
Well,
I'm not saying that's us. I'm not saying that's what we would do, but I could see the reasoning.
He's also a guy that served two tours in Vietnam, so you assume he has seen shit before.
Yeah.
So
that's
true. So unlike you or I,
right.
You
this
know,
isn't
where the worst thing we've ever had to deal with is a Black Friday crowd.
Right.
he's seen dead bodies before.
That can get violent, by the way, just FYI.
And he's actually probably killed people before in war.
Right.
In Vietnam, right? So it's not like you're right, exactly. I mean, and that's the thing. Like all
I'm just like if I walked upon that scene with a truck full of drugs and a bag full of money, I'm just like, this situation is nothing but bad news. I'm getting the fuck out of here.
Well, that's the thing. He thought he could take the money and be done with it, which he probably would have been if he didn't go back.
But that leads us to the question of the idea of fate and the idea of destiny and the idea of choice is, you know, did Chigurh really have a choice over whether or not he kills the wife? Did, you know, how much of his say did he really have, or how much was he compelled to do it by who he is? And how much is Llewellyn making bad decisions versus Llewellyn being who Llewellyn is? We can all come up with something that we might have choices about or might not have choices about, but we also have things that we know that because we are who we are, good, bad, or indifferent, it's going to dictate. We would never, another possibility would never come across our minds, right?
Right,
we would never,
right.
You know, so, you know, whether you would bend down to pet the puppy or kick the puppy, you know, I don't think anybody here would kick the puppy.
Right.
I know Phil wouldn't.
That's correct.
But, and you say, well, he had a choice. He did have a choice, but not really.
Right. It's in his nature.
It's in his nature to not kick the puppy.
He's wired wrong.
I see what you're saying.
He's wired wrong or whatever for Chigurh.
And in Chigurh, right, he doesn't have the way he's wired, he doesn't really have a choice. You know, you could go the same thing with, you know, is there a cop?
No, but the interesting thing about his character is that he's in complete denial about it.
Right.
And he thinks that flipping the coin is fate when actually he just wants to kill people.
Also, Mike, it brings the fact that the recognition of what is a sociopath or mentally ill, in the sense that you have the medical definition, which is exactly what you're saying here, because he can't stop himself from doing these things. And like you said, Eric, he's tricking himself to think that it's the coin and not really him. But the judicial definition of someone that's a sociopath or mentally ill is that he recognizes what he's doing is wrong, or he should recognize what he's doing wrong. In other words, he knows that killing the person is a crime, and yet he does it anyway. So while the doctor would say he knows it's wrong, but he can't help himself because he's a sociopath. So the thing is that he knows he's doing it wrong, and he can say whatever he wants to himself, but he still knows what he's doing is insane, even if he's wired to be insane that way. It's like OCD. You know you're doing OCD. You know that you're doing something stupid. Like my wife at one point, you know, it was like touching a doorknob, and yet, you know, she works at a school where kids is touching, is spitting everywhere, and she goes, that's a good point. So I never thought of that. So
how is she supposed to get out of the room, Phil?
Well, that's my point. It's like at school it didn't matter, but, you know, at the store it did, and yet it doesn't make any sense. And the point is that you know you're doing something insane with OCD, and you know it's wrong, yet you still do it anyway. And so this guy here knows what he's doing is a certain way, and yet he knows he doesn't have to do it that way. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's too bad that people in movies aren't perfect like me.
There you go.
But you have your OCD stuff too. You've got this weird thing about alphabetizing your DVDs.
That's not true. OCD. That's just common sense.
Is Chrissy still on this?
I don't know.
But Mike, that.
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm just listening to you guys talk.
Yeah. But Mike, you're absolutely right though that he, yeah, it's like he's programmed to do these things. But that's where I'll still debate and say whether he's programmed or not because of his mental illness. He still knows that it's he doesn't have to do it.
Right. And but again, this is a philosophical thing. It's not a legal argument. You know, you can't say, well, Your Honor, I was compelled to shoot the guy. Oh, well, as long as you were compelled and didn't have a choice.
Then it's not illegal, yeah.
Right, right.
No. So last scene to talk about is the last scene when he gets nailed by the guy running the light.
Right.
I started laughing tonight when I watched it again, when a kid just walks up and goes, "Mister, you got a bone sticking out of your arm."
And the kid says it like twice. And then it was one of his eyes is like bloodied off completely. And it's almost like a flashback to Llewellyn on the bridge when the guy goes, "Did you get in a car accident?"
Yeah, goes, right, right.
He goes, yeah. I'll buy a jacket for $100 and everything. And then the kid says again, "Sir, how did that happen? Did you get in a car accident?" And that's almost like a flash forward to what happens to Shigura.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
I didn't think about that. That's neat.
Yep.
Well, you know what else was interesting about that ending too is when he offers the kid the money. And the kid's like, "No, hell no, mister. I don't need that. I'll just give you my shirt." Uh-huh. But then the guy insists that he take it. And he says, you know, Sugar says, "Take this. And you never saw me." And then as Sugar's walking away, the kids start arguing.
Yeah, you know, and part of that's fine, right?
Well, and that, again,
you still got your shirt.
The scene on the bridge was the same way.
Yeah.
Because they were arguing about the money because it was my jacket and whatever. And the same thing with these kids too. So the whole scenes are almost like mirror images.
Do you think it's foreshadowing then the same fate for Shigure has happened with Moss?
Yeah, possibly. It wouldn't surprise me that people are now after Shigure because he can't become do more hitch jobs for other people because he just murdered everybody. So they're going to say that guy's going to be taken out. He's insane. You know, he's ruining it. He's bringing the FBI on us.
Who's accepting that contract? That's what I want to know.
But the thing is,
as long as you get money, dude, they're going to take it.
They did that foreshadowing earlier, like I said, with the blood trail of the pronghorn. So it wouldn't surprise me if that sort of was foreshadowing. But why I thought that thing about arguing over the money was interesting was because to me, it tied in once again with this whole idea that money corrupts. I mean, here these kids are, right. You know, "Oh, let me help you. Oh my God, you're bleeding." You know, they don't know this guy is a terrible man. They don't know how dangerous this guy is.
Money. Yep.
And then all of a sudden, 2 seconds later, they're like little bastards fighting over cash. Yep.
Right. And they don't even.
That just really was very telling to me.
And they don't even question when Shigure says, you don't know I'm here. Pretend I'm not here. Or, you know, in other words, basically, don't tell the cops what I look like or anything like that. You know, and they don't even think twice about it.
And Chrissy, even the idea of corruption of money goes to Shigure and, you know, what's the thing he's always got on him? His coins. You know, he uses the coins as a tool. You know, he uses it to decide if you know, in some cases, who lives and who dies. Right. You know, so even there, the money is a corrupting influence.
He uses the dime to get the sackle at the end.
Yeah.
You know, so, you're absolutely right. Money is the everything goes to shit in this movie because of money. Everything's money, from the drug deal going bad to Llewellyn Moss being chased to all the hitmen being hired to Carson Wells.
Well, except for the mother-in-law, she's still got the cancer.
She sure does. Yeah, but she's dead. She died of cancer. Now, she was 58 years old
It wasn't money cancer.
Right.
So.
Her death had nothing to do with money. It was just bad luck because of the cancer. I got the cancer.
Oh, the fact that she calls it the cancer is the best.
Yeah.
The cancer.
It's like the marijuana.
Yeah.
And then she goes, "When you met Llewellyn, I just thought of two words, no and good." instead of just saying no good. No. And good.
And now again, the money in the dream, right? Was the dad gave?
Oh yeah, and he loses
him money. So if the money represents evil or corruption, so again, that ties into he handed him the kind of passed the baton of the law enforcement.
Right.
You know, left the law enforcement in his hands, and well, now he lost it. He lost the ability to control the corruption.
Well, and then the uncle, when the uncle talks about one of the brothers, because I think it was the uncle, and then it was his father, and then it was their like grandfather or great uncle or something that they're talking about. He goes, "Yeah, I gave the award that you know your great uncle got to you know some museum." And he goes, "You never told me that story about what happened to him. Why don't you tell me?" And then he talks about how it was like 1902 or something, and the great uncle gets a knock on the door, and there's a bunch of Indians there, like 7 or 8 of them, and they're complaining about something or rather this or that and whatever. And then and he says that he can't do anything, and so they start threatening him. So he goes, turns around to go back in to get the shotgun and just say, "Get off my property," and they shoot him from in the back, and then they just watch him dead while the wife is holding him and he's dying. And the point is, the whole of the story was, again, that's that people suck, because you know, and whether it was Native Americans or not, the point is that people suck. And because that guy didn't deserve to be shot, he didn't deserve to die in his wife's hands, and the point of his job was to be a lawman, and he was a good lawman, not you know the bad crap the cops get nowadays, and he's dead and he's forgotten and whatever, and then I don't know, and so I thought that was a pretty interesting story as well. I had to replay it a couple of times because I was trying to figure out what they were trying to say in that, and I don't know if any of you heard anything about it or have thoughts on it or anything.
People suck.
Pretty much.
Those are my thoughts. You should never help them. Bad things happen.
Right. Well, and that's what happened, is that the guy that says he can't help him, there's nothing I can do, and then so they shoot him. So that kind of sucks. So you're not going to help me, I'm going to shoot you, but if you do help me, I'm going to demand you to take the chicken crates out of the truck and put a hole in your head.
So you're just really fucked no matter what.
Right. There's no hope. How about when Tommy Lee Jones is talking to the deputy, and he goes, "So you're trying to tell me he took a pocket knife to pull out the bullet out of his head because they don't found no bullet?" I don't want to think of that. He goes, "Yeah, I don't want to think about that either."
Right? Because they couldn't figure out it was a bolt gun.
Or even at the like later in the film when he's talking about the bolt gun, he's talking about the farm and the bolt gun that was used to kill the cows.
And she goes, "Why did you tell me that story?" He goes, "I don't know. My mind wandered."
Right, and then later in the movie, she brings up the farmer's name, whatever it was. Let's just say it's Smith. He goes, "Yeah, so it's almost just like that farmer Smith that you told me about." And he goes, "Who?" Because he just made the fucking story up.
It's not even a story true. Well, it was a story, and it's true that it was a story.
Right.
He was basically just trying to scare her or something to help her out, and it didn't work.
Oh, God.
The movie's the best. The best!
All right, let's wrap this up, shall we?
Dude, we got to talk about it for another 4 hours. It's the best!
No, we don't. Well, then I'm signing off now.
All right, we'll wrap it up now. So, let's give our final thoughts of the film, because we're already at 2 hours. Let's do a couple of house cleanings just to make it quick. Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askansity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify.
And Eric, you also do another podcast with me and Mike?
I do. That one is about the HBO television show Game of Thrones. It's called You Know Nothing, Jon Snow. We will be recording an episode every week after each episode airs for the final season. So tune in to listen to us talk about that.
Excellent. And Mike, you do a podcast with me, and you also have a blog, too.
Well, I also do the podcast Searching for American Gods with you, which is about the Starz TV series American Gods, which is heading into its final 2 episodes of its second season, and then we will be going on hiatus. And I also have a blog, which is Unnatural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com.
And Chrissy, you have some exciting news to promote.
I do. That's right. You can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com. I write short dark fiction, and my latest collection, The Shadows Behind, which contains some brand new stories, some favorites that are out of print. And when I say favorites, I mean the ones that readers have written to me about over the years that you can no longer get because they were published like, you know, 20 years ago in tiny magazines that are actually out of print because they were pre-internet. And that is going to be released from Books and Booze Press on April 30th. So I will keep you guys posted with the link, and I'll probably go put the link on the Facebook page when it's finally available, just in case anyone's interested. But yep, it's big and it's exciting, and I'm thrilled. So I'm very excited.
Excellent. Very good. And I actually have a new short story that just came out in an anthology called In the Shadow of the Mountain.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's a let's see here. Here's the blurb. It goes, not every fantasy has a happily ever after. Worlds collapse, kings fall, races fade into distant memory. And the Shadow of the Mountain will take you into the darkest recesses of the human, dwarven, and Valkyrie soul. Dive deep into the caverns of the mountains and climb to the highest peak, but don't expect to come out the same as when you went in. And so it's a fantasy anthology of fantasy tales. Mine was called, I believe, The Light Beyond the Churchyard. And it's basically...
It's a fantasy story?
Yeah, it takes place in an alternate world type things, yeah.
Yeah, so help me God, there better not be a character named Sansa.
They're not, no. I think... I can't remember the names, but I think that it's Freya and Patricia are the two characters' names, but I can't remember. Because it's supposed to be like Teutonic folks. So it takes place in, like, England or something. And... in an alternate dimension where two warrior knights that happen to be female head to a deserted area in a swamp where there used to be an old church that a necromancer is supposed to be, I guess, creating evils and whatnot. So it's a journey of two, a religious person and a barbarian knight type person. So In the Shadow of the Mountain, which can be purchased on Amazon. So let's see. Now let's give our final thoughts on this movie here. So let's start with you, Mike.
Yeah, it's an awesome film. It's, you know, the Coen brothers have produced a lot of good work over the years, and, you know, this is without a question one of their very best. It's pitch perfect pretty much from script to screen. You know, and I can't really think of a lot of flaws. It's a lot of stuff that's unconventional, especially towards the end, but it's not necessarily flawed. So I highly recommend it. If you haven't seen it, you know, please go watch it. There's a lot to chew on. There's a lot to think about. And then, you know, probably rewatch it again.
All right, very good. Besides how awesome the film is in general, whether acting, directing, story, or whatnot, I think the most amazing thing about it is the portrayal of a sociopath or psychopath. Anton Chigurh is arguably one of the greatest sociopaths or psychopaths I've ever seen in film or book. It's just amazing portrayal by Javier Bardem, never mind everybody else in the film as well. One of the highest recommends I could ever give for any film. Obviously, as Chrissy said, it is specific to your taste, because if you don't like overly violent films, and again, the violence is, as Chrissy said, when needed, it's still fairly intense and violent that you may or may not like the film depending on your perspective. But all in all, one of the best films I've ever seen, and I would highly recommend it. Eric?
Yeah, this movie is a classic. I would encourage everybody to own a copy on disc.
Chrissy?
I absolutely echo everything everybody else said. I really don't have more to add. Get it on disc. It's a great film. Everybody should see it. And, I mean, I can't disagree with you guys. I think it's good. So.
All right. And Chrissy summed it up perfectly, why the disc should never die, because 4K, 2K, Blu-ray, whatever, just has a so much better quality of picture and sound than general streaming. So definitely a disc is always a good thing, especially for a movie like this. If you guys want to reach us, out to us. www.darkdiscussions.com is the website. darkdiscussions@aol.com is the email. We would love to hear your thoughts on this film or any Coen film or any sociopath in film that you could add to the conversation. Also, you can post and talk about it on Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, where a lot of times we grab comments and such from that page and read them also on the website. I mean, on the podcast, because a lot of the comments that are discussed are most certainly worthy and useful to the discussion on the podcast, too. So check us out. And I guess with that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about No Country for Old Men. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.
Child, come up on some pages on an old brush pile, torn up pictures of some people getting wild, wondering why it stayed with me so long. On a train shooting through the lonely night, trying to get home, baby, for broad daylight. I'm just sitting back sipping on some day-old wine, slow and easy one more time. Slow and easy one more time. No more peaceful than I was when I was wild. Slow and easy, gotta get that same old high. Slow and easy, slow and easy one more time. Be blamed. Meet so many people with so many goddamn names. Please forgive me, I'm insane. Walk through the garden with my black thumb. Plenty of rain this year, but hardly any sun. Tangled up in my old mess of weeds and vines. That's alright, have another sip of wine. Slow and easy one more time. No more graceful than I was when I was a child. Slow and easy, gotta get that same old high. Slow and easy, slow and easy one more time. Sometimes I'm crying late at night, I can't make it by myself. You ain't never gonna hear me say, I won't hit that long road. No, no, no. Baby, don't you hear me when I'm crying? Don't put my love back on your shelf. No, no. And I hope you feel it in your heart when I tell you, oh, baby, come back home. Oh, baby, take me home. Home, baby, for broad daylight. I'm just sitting back, sipping on some day-old wine. Slow and easy one more time. Slow and easy one more time. No more peaceful than I was when I was wild. Slow and easy, gotta get that same old high. Slow and easy one more time.